Taking Stock with Vincent Wall.
Brought to you by PwC. We balance business understanding with technology innovation and human insight. PwC.ie.
This is News Talk.
You're welcome to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Vincent Wall, and each week we take a wide review of some of the major shifts in the global economy and those closer to home. You can get in contact with us by emailing takingstock@newstalk.com or on Twitter at takingstocknt. Now here on Taking Stock, as well as gaining a perspective from the present and looking to the future, we also occasionally draw from the past. To help us do that, we're joined now by John Isle, a former financial journalist and now head of communications with Goodbody. John, you're very welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Vincent.
Let's go back to this.
The FBI arrested him this morning after he told senior employees yesterday that his business was a giant Ponzi scheme.
Wall Street veteran Bernard Madoff has been arrested and charged with running a $50 billion Ponzi scheme. This is one of the biggest fraud cases ever.
Any idea how long this has been going on?
It's a key question. And investigators have been in there for about a week. At this point, I'm not sure they have any idea. All we really have is what Madoff told his two sons a week ago about the fraud. And yet, many people are starting to believe it may have been from the very beginning.
Yeah, and how can he pull this off by himself?
It seems almost impossible.
He is 70 years old. He will plead guilty to 11 criminal counts and almost certainly spend the rest of his life in prison. And there goes Bernie Madoff.
Disgraced money manager Bernard Madoff behind bars at this hour after pleading guilty to a massive Ponzi scheme. After saying he was deeply sorry and ashamed, Madoff pleaded guilty to 11 charges that could send the 70-year-old to, well, prison for 150 years.
Series of reports there, John, into the original arrest and then the subsequent jailing for an enormous amount of time, 10 years ago this summer, of Bernie Madoff, the largest fraudster in American and probably global corporate history. Who was this guy, apart from being a New Yorker like yourself?
Well, before his fraud emerged in 2008, when the markets were in turmoil there towards the end of the year, and we all remember that very well here in Ireland, just how crazy those days were, Bernie Madoff was actually a legitimate Wall Street operator who got his start in the 1960s as a penny stock trader. And what he did was he made markets in small stocks. He started with a very small stake, partly through odd jobs he did over the summer after college as a lifeguard and other sort of summer jobs like that, and a loan from his father-in-law. And with that money, about $40,000 or $50,000, started his securities firm. And basically what he did was he made a market in these small stocks, and he took small orders that the bigger banks wouldn't take, and basically worked through a certain amount of hard graft and built up quite a successful business, which then moved into electronic trading and was one of the pioneers, in fact, of electronic trading in the late 1960s into the 70s and 80s. And he was so successful that eventually he became chair of the NASDAQ. Yeah. His firm was one of four or five that was processing about half of the New York Stock Exchange's trades at one point. And he also he came up with a financial innovation at the time, which was maybe a look into the future, which was to sort of pay for placement, right? And the way he described it was, if you're going to buy stockings in the department store, the certain stocking manufacturer is going to pay for placement in that department store so that, you know, their product is closer to the entrance or is on the aisle rather than deep inside the store. And he said, well, my way of paying for trading placement is basically exactly that. But not everybody agreed with him. OK, so that's the early Bernie, the innovator, the hardworking stock market maker who was doing legitimate trading back and forth for the small time type of client. And then he eventually got big.
So either from his own words or through the trial and the investigations, when did that early Bernie, legitimate, innovative, turn into the greatest Ponzi operator in history?
Well, it seems that both of those things ran in parallel. So while he had the market making part of his business, so what a market maker does is it is both buying and selling securities on its own book, right, with the goal of making a profit on the spread between what you buy and what you sell, right? So that's a very simple way of putting it. And that's what Bernie did. And he put trades through for other clients, not just trading his own proprietary desk, but also for the small-time clients who were doing what he called crumbs, okay? And if you do enough volume, the crumbs, you know, maybe add up to a whole loaf of bread. So he was running that business all along, and it was successful and legitimate. It's important to say that, right? So he then built a reputation as that guy, trading for these clients, small-time people, a lot initially who were family and friends. And that's important because later on, when he started his investment management and advisory business, which was about creating investment portfolios rather than just buying and selling securities, he leaned on that same friends and family network to build up this advisory business. And essentially what happened then was he would sort of take in the client money. In the simple way, this is how the scam worked. He took in the client money, claimed to invest it, but in fact didn't. And then he fabricated the returns on these investments, usually very high returns, sort of 16, 18% per year. Even in down markets, his portfolios managed to perform well. And that attracted more clients, right? So they said, I want some of that. I want those returns. And the network grew and grew. More money piled in. But really what he was doing was keeping it in a simple deposit account. And when a client would take their money out, which was rare enough because a lot of money was coming in and people wanted to stay invested for these great returns, a client would redeem their account and he would just pay it out of the bank account, which is fine as long as the money is coming in. And what unraveled...
And as long as he's getting more and more clients, he's exactly, supposed to keep the cash flowing.
Precisely. And what happened was this began to unravel, obviously, in 2008. Massive market panic. By November of that year, I think the Standard & Poor's 500 index was down 39% by November, and somehow Madoff's portfolios were up 4% at that stage. But clients were beginning to panic, pulling their money out, and he was getting down to close to zero. And then finally, he had to just confess to his family, brought them into a room and said, it's all a lie. I've been running a Ponzi scheme. There are no investment accounts. This is just cash, and now it's run out.
By his own account, he claims to have been a legitimate trader up to around the time of the stock market crash in 1987, and then just given the complexity of the investments that he had made, he couldn't draw down sufficient cash for some of his more panicky investors to pay them, so he started making it up. And yet the investigators and others think perhaps the fraud went way back beyond that.
I think that explanation is quite dubious, actually. And in fact, his co-conspirator, who turned state's evidence, Frank DiPasquale, said that it was almost from the beginning of the firm that Bernie started to do this. While he was running the legitimate market-making business, he was also doing this Ponzi scheme with private client investors and possibly back as early as 1964. So this scam ran for more than four decades. And what's fascinating about that is that he was able to manage to keep the new money coming in fast enough that any redemptions would be covered by sheer cash. And also that the bank he was depositing this money with, which was Chase Bank at the time, which later became J.P. Morgan Chase, which is now just J.P. Morgan, thought nothing suspicious of Madoff Securities keeping what turned out to be billions in deposit, just sitting there doing nothing, earning whatever nominal interest or, you know, whatever the account was paying, that the Security and Exchange Commission never wondered why there were no counterparties to Madoff trades, why the order books always showed these spectacularly profitable and well-timed trades, which he had actually backdated with one of his other co-conspirators in the firm. There was all of this stuff that was red flagged that if anybody had actually looked at it carefully, would have seen very quickly that the entire operation was built on sand.
And yet it wasn't as if it went unnoticed. Harry Markopoulos, a hedge fund operator, a financial investigator, tried to blow the whistle on him from the 1990s onwards, basically did some investigations himself and concluded that he couldn't be legitimately, even mathematically, making the returns he was making, and tried to draw the attention of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the regulator, on two separate occasions, and wrote a book about it, says nobody wants to know.
That's right. Harry Markopoulos claims he did 4 hours worth of mathematical calculations that proved there was no way Madoff could be making the returns he was making using the strategy he claimed to be using. So Madoff said he was doing what's called it's called a split strike conversion. And effectively what that is you you buy sort of blue chip stocks and then you buy options on either side of that trade. So you buy, you know, the option to buy at a certain price higher than what you've already bought at. Lower than what you've already bought at, and then option to sell at a price higher than what you've bought. So you put what's called a collar on the trade. So you minimize your losses.
So you basically narrow your risk.
Exactly. You narrow your risk, but you also, so you minimize your gains as well. But if you can pull off that strategy, you should get consistent returns on the stocks you invest in. However, what Markopoulos figured out was that given the size of the Madoff portfolios, if he was actually doing that strategy on his whole book, there wasn't enough volume in the market to actually do that. So there weren't enough trades on the counterparty side to actually make that happen. So this is the mathematical part. He says it's impossible for him to be doing what he's doing. He must be doing something else. It looks like a Ponzi scheme.
And in fact, what he was doing wasn't any sort of trading at all, simple or complex. He was simply making up the trades in a very realistic way in terms of the receipts and the documentation for the trades, but there were no trades.
That's right. So he had a sort of phantom compliance department in his securities firm, the whole purpose of which was not to actually book the trades and report them. But what Madoff would do is he would take in money. He would say, okay, Vincent, you're my client. You've given me €1 million. I'm now going to invest that. Now, he wouldn't tell you outright how he was going to invest that. He would watch the performance of, say, the top 25 or 30 companies in the S&P 500 index. He would look at their performance, and then he would sort of fabricate a trade to create the return he told you that you got. So let's say you get to the end of the quarter and he says, I've done great for you, Vincent. You're 17% up in the last 3 months, right? He would then go and find the trades he had to have made in the market at the time, and then he would have his compliance department fabricate and backdate these trades so that if the Securities and Exchange Commission ever came to look, they would see that he had bought IBM at just the right time to make, you know, a killing here, or he had bought Microsoft at just the right time, and so forth. So there were no duds in his portfolios. And I mean, they were phantom portfolios anyway, but there were no duds. There were all this great buying and stock picking that he was doing, and this very clever collar trades that he would put on everything to make it all happen. But actually, during the investigation, they realized that the system wasn't as tight as it could have been. There were some trades that were marked for weekends or holidays. There were some prices were wrong. So anyone who had actually done even a sampling, I think, a random sampling of his trade book would have found a lot of irregularities.
Harry Markopoulos tried to blow the whistle on him twice. When the subsequent investigations emerged, it was confirmed that the SEC looked at Madoff's operations at least six times from the early 90s onwards, and either were incompetent or afraid because of his reputation, but basically missed it.
Well, they got close in 2005, where they actually requested a list of his trading partners. Right? Where did you place these trades? And then we'll go and see how it actually happened on the market. And he produced a list for them, and they never called anybody, as it turns out. So they just took the list of counterparties as proof of counterparties instead of actually trying to verify even one or two of them. And had they done that, they would have found, actually, Madoff didn't trade through any of these places. Or if he did, it doesn't match the order books that he has in his own shop. So we have to dig a little bit deeper. I mean, one of the hints that the regulators should have seen is that virtually everybody who had a control function in his securities firm was a family member.
Yeah.
So it was run like a mafia, essentially. All these connected parties. Now, I mean, I can tell you from the way Goodbody works is our compliance department is actually behind a locked door, that if you're a trader, you have no access to that room. You wave your key card at the entry pad and it flashes red. You can't go in there. So the traders and the compliance people don't talk to each other. And then you have your investment advisors. They don't talk to the traders either. So all of these in a properly regulated securities firm, these people are all segregated. They're kept away from one another. They keep the Chinese walls in place. So not only is there no impropriety, but there's no appearance of impropriety either. In Bernie's firm, you had all of these people who basically went home together and lived in the same houses. You know, they met each other for, weekend barbecues. This was the level of compliance here. His brother-in-law was head of compliance. His niece was legal counsel. His two sons were head of important parts of the business. So it was kept very close. like an organized crime operation, in effect. And because of that, very little was leaking out. But if anybody had actually looked at that and said, that's a little bit strange, most securities firms aren't organized in this way, perhaps we should take a closer look.
The Securities and Exchange Commission, as you say, they got close in 2005, but just didn't go that step further that they needed to do, ask the right questions. Could that have been as well because Madoff was a big noise in New York society? Had three or four wonderful apartments, a big motor yacht. He was chairman of the NASDAQ exchange. He was assistant chairman of one of the regulatory bodies for investment activity. And he had a lot of big, particularly Jewish clients, but also charities, hospitals, a lot of very substantial clients.
Yeah, so Bernie did very well in, let's say, infiltrating society, and especially Jewish New York society. He was a patron of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue, which is an Upper East Side Orthodox synagogue with a lot of very wealthy businessmen and businesswomen who are members of the congregation there. And that was one of his main sort of marketing arms, actually, was his connections through the synagogue. The Elie Wiesel Foundation was a client. So was Hadassah, which is probably the largest Jewish women's organization in the world. These are big foundations with big budgets who were placing a lot of their money with Madoff. So he had the trust of New York's Jewish community and was considered really a great person because he was making money for everybody, or so it appeared. And I think if you think back to what that time was like, as the real estate market was taking off and people were making tons of money through investments, I think there was a reluctance, as Greenspan said at the time, of taking the punch bowl away. And the regulators all over the world had a pretty light touch because it looked like nobody wanted to stop the party, essentially. And I think that sort of psychology is very hard to avoid in situations like that. I mean, you see it today with the Jeffrey Epstein case, which is full, like, is tragic from start to finish. But one of the central mysteries about Jeffrey Epstein is, where did his money come from? He's another one who claimed he was running a hedge fund, has a net worth of his estate now is $559 million. But where did that money come from? Nobody else on Wall Street says they ever did a trade with him. None of the trading desks had him as a client. So what actually was going on there? Did he really have an investment company, or was it some other kind of operation? The fact that this can still happen, that there can be rumors and suspicions about a person without any kind of hard evidence or without regulators really taking a punt on trying to find out what's going on under the hood, is fascinating to me. And I think there is a reluctance in these big money centers like New York or like London to dig too deeply to find out where it all comes from.
Maybe that, and maybe, as some observers have written about Madoff in particular, that the lie was just so big, the Securities and Exchange Commission's imagination just couldn't encapsulate it. Perhaps that's just a soft view. By his own account, the 1987 crash caused him to become fraudulent, but it was the 2008 crash that ultimately rumbled him.
Well, there was no place to hide in 2008, and I mean, entire banks went under, right? So Lehman Brothers disappeared in September, this 100-year-old institution that people thought would be there forever. The fact was that the losses on the market were just too great and people were just too scared. So there was no talking people down from.
So they were looking for their cash.
They wanted their cash, yeah. And so the problem is, if you say, oh, I have you invested in a blue chip portfolio, and they say, well, actually, I'd prefer to have that in cash because it looks like markets are going down further. You know, the pity there was that, well, it's already in cash. there's no flight to safety here. So I think his accounts had something like $5.5 or $6 billion at the time. But the size of the fraud was $55 billion. So 10 times the size of the deposits that he actually had. But the flip side of that, a lot of people forget, at least half of his clients over the years had pulled their money out or redeemed their investments at a profit. So he was able to sort of fraudulently produce profits for a large number of people, some of whom ultimately earned billions over the years.
More than he did, seemingly.
More than he did, exactly. And now he was a very wealthy man, but there were some of his others, what they called the big four, Carl Shapiro, Jeffrey Picower, Stanley Chase, and Norm Levy. They had a very long and profitable involvement with Madoff, and Picower himself, I think, ultimately had to give back over $1 billion worth of his fraudulent gains. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean he knew what the scam was, but that ultimately the money he made on the investments wasn't really from an investment. It wasn't his. It was part of the fraud. And I think about half of the money, about 18 million, was lost from
18 billion.
Yeah, sorry, excuse me. 18 billion was lost. But there are these, you know, the recovery fund has paid back a certain amount, 13.3 billion, I think, of the losses have been paid back to date. And there's still a few more coming from the Madoff fund that was created by the Department of Justice to go out and reclaim money that was fraudulently collected, I guess, by various clients of Madoff.
He tells his sons in December 2008 that the whole thing is built on a lie. They, whether shocked or not, they immediately get legal advice that he should turn him in. He is turned in, arrested. And then, as we noted, he's jailed for 150 years, 10 years ago this summer. He's still languishing in a North Carolina jail.
He is, as an 81-year-old man. He probably doesn't have a whole lot longer to stay in jail, but he'll be there for life. The human wreckage of this story is just incredible. So you have not only his sons. Imagine that conversation, whether his sons knew or not at the time. So either the sons had no idea and he confesses to them. It's all falling apart. It's built on lies. I just have cash deposits. It's a Ponzi scheme. And there's no more money to pay people out. If they didn't know that, they're shocked. My father's been lying to me my entire life. If they did know about it, they're terrified because they're implicated now. His wife claims she knew nothing, although they had this lavish lifestyle. She was allowed to keep $2.5 million and now lives in a home in Connecticut. She had to give up her Upper East Side townhouse. His brother was the longtime chief compliance officer in the firm. He's serving a 10-year sentence, so he'll be getting out soon. His niece was involved. Now, she didn't do time and ultimately married an SEC investigator who she met while he was investigating the case. He has since resigned from the SEC.
And I thought only Ireland was small.
Yeah, exactly. They were allowed to go off and live happily ever after. His right-hand man, Frank DiPascali, turned state's evidence and basically explained the whole scam, claims that it went back to 1975, even though they couldn't prove beyond a certain date that that was happening. And then another woman, Annette Bongiorno, she's the one who fabricated all of the trades. She was another longtime Bernie Madoff employee. So there were five people went to prison over this. But then, tragically, his son, Mark Madoff, died of suicide 2 years to the day after his father was convicted. And then his younger son, Andrew, died of cancer in 2014. But apart from that, there were numerous suicides among Madoff clients, people who had been who did not come out of it positively, who had lost money that was not recoverable or not fully recoverable anyway. And then there were also some charitable foundations, some of which had to close because they had parked their money with Madoff and then it actually wasn't there when they needed it. So the consequences of this, you know, it's not just a curiosity or this one rich man who, you know, fraudulently obtained his wealth and it blew his family up. It actually blew up many, many families over this. You know, people who were expecting to, say, retire with a certain amount of money or that they'd put money away for their own children or education funds or whatever it was. That money then wasn't there for them. And amidst all of the wreckage of the crash in 2008, this one was, I think, particularly painful for the people involved because they regarded him as a friend. They regarded him either as a family member. They had a religious relationship with him, a charitable relationship. This is all very intimate and emotionally fraught, I think. And so it was a bit tougher for them to take than maybe, oh, well, you know, this mortgage-backed security blew up and it's sort of 6 degrees of separation away from you. This was a guy that they would see every week. The kind of person that they knew very well and their kids played together, that sort of a thing. It's really hurting your neighbor.
It seems a relatively low security regime he's in now in Butner, North Carolina. He's done a number of interviews, including for a recent podcast, I think Ponzi Supernova on Audible. He's talked to the FT over the years. And he does acknowledge fully his guilt. He's getting therapy. Obviously, he's huge grief about what's happened to his sons and the fact his wife's not in touch. But he claims absolutely he operated on his own with no major counterparties other than perhaps some of his employees. And he blames the greed of his clients for much of what happened.
It's tough for me to reconcile those two positions, that on the one hand, he accepts his guilt and that also he blames the greed of his clients. I think once he went down that road, it became impossible to back out at some point, and that the clients began demanding a certain level of performance from him. That is completely believable. It's also believable that many of his clients might have suspected that not everything was completely above board, that they could be getting double-digit gains even while the market was going down. I think you'd have to question what was actually happening at your investment advisor if that was ever happening. But also, some people just give their money over to the advisor and really don't want to know. They just like an annual account statement, and they're not financial experts, and they're counting on you to be compliant. They're counting on you to be an expert. They're counting on you to invest as you said you would invest, because financial markets are based on trust ultimately. Now, it's trust that has to be verified, but ultimately it's based on trust. So I think there's a little bit of self-exculpation going on there with Bernie Madoff that he hasn't quite reconciled for himself. Maybe what he was doing and who was ultimately responsible.
And will we ever know, do you think, whether there were any other major parties who were at least complicit, if not actively involved? The bankruptcy trustee who has been appointed to chase back some of the money, the wonderfully named Irving Picard, he's actually got a lot of the money back through suing some of the clients, including some of the banks, even though there is no criminal evidence against them.
Yeah, and including this was a great one, the New York Mets, the owner of the baseball team. The owners of the baseball team, I think, had to give back about $162 million. So yeah, that's the one, you know, the one bit of this that actually has worked well is the Department of Justice has this ability to go after people. And I think rather than try to fight City Hall, so to speak, they make a settlement. And a lot of money has been clawed back in that way. I wonder if we ever will know the full story. Keep in mind that a lot of the people who would have been affected by this have, you know, passed away through natural causes or aging now and so forth. And there isn't a whole lot in it for anybody to kind of reveal exactly what happened. I mean, if you look at, say, the biggest political scandal in U.S. history, Watergate, we didn't really get the final story on that until about 45 years afterwards. So it may eventually tumble out. But I think Wall Street forgets very quickly and financial markets move on.
Wall Street does forget very quickly, but are there any lessons in the past? Have the regulators learned?
I can see from the way our firm is regulated that there is a much different atmosphere, I think, than it was 10 years ago. So 10 years ago, I was a reporter covering this, and I remember the experience as stories like this tumbled out, or stories about Anglo-Irish Bank or Irish Nationwide Bank or any of the institutions that blew up here. It was, each one was amazing as it happened, because you had this belief that surely things were looked after more carefully than that. And I think now there is maybe, some people say, an overcompensation. I wouldn't happen to agree with that. I think the sector is properly regulated now. But some people say an overcompensation. It's a compliance-led industry now. So I see this at work all the time that, you know, the question is always asked, well, okay, we have this great idea for, say, marketing, right? We're going to market this new product. And someone always pipes up and says, yeah, but will that be okay with compliance? So there is that attitude that is now embedded in firms, and a generation has changed over as well, right? So don't forget, the people who have been coming into the industry now for the last decade are people who are, you know, fairly young when this all happened, and their lives and expectations have been shaped by the aftermath of the financial crisis, and they don't even have a memory of what life was like before then. So there is a generation, I'd say people around my age, who are maybe looking back fondly and saying, God, I love the bonuses back in 2006, but they're never coming back either. The incentives have really changed a lot in the markets. Now, who knows? It may ultimately, the complacency may creep in again. That can always happen in any regulated area, where it has worked well for so long that we just relax our guard. And that's probably what happened in 2008 to a certain extent. But at the moment, I think the trauma is so recent that that type of scandal, I mean, if it was happening, I think more people would be trying to find out about it.
We leave it there. My thanks to John Isle, Bernie Madoff, 10 years in a North Carolina federal institution and counting. He's due to get out, I think, in 2139. I won't be about to see him out, John. You're younger than me, you may be. But John Isle, former financial journalist and now head of communications with Goodbody, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Vincent.
We're joined now by Dr. Joachim Lang, Director General of the Federation of German Industries and member of the Presidential Board. Joachim, you're very welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
You're here for a number of days to talk to a number of stakeholders, including business stakeholders, about matters generally relating to the German economy, to the EU economy, global trade. But I suppose we're all fixated on Brexit, and it's an issue, obviously, for German industry as well. The UK is your fifth largest export economy. Exports to the UK have fallen significantly in recent months and weeks. We might find it a little bit strange here in Ireland to believe that, you know, Germany generally and German businesses in particular are so supportive of the backstop being there as a red line in terms of EU-UK agreements that you know, in principle you might be supportive of it, but the UK is such an important market that you must be putting pressure on your government behind the scenes to come to some sort of a resolution even before the end of October.
The situation is completely different. We are totally supportive of the position of our government, and this is all over business in Germany, and we are a part of the EU27, and we all feel the same. We all think that this is a lose-lose situation and that the only task that is left now is to reduce the inevitable damage that is coming. So we need to protect the single market because we all know how good this works for us. Maybe we forgot how brilliant the idea of the European Union is, not only for us as people who live in the European Union, but also for our businesses. And if there's only one thing that's good about the Brexit is that we look deep into the construction of the European Union, and we all understood how well this works. And we are the most intertwined economic region in the world, and we all benefit from it. And it, from an economic point of view, it doesn't make sense to leave it.
So in terms of the backstop specifically, do you think it's fair to say that you and your colleagues in German industry are supportive of the challenges that would arise in principle with a border on the island of Ireland, but that it's also critical in your view as a frontier for the single market?
Yes, it's a price that we all will have to pay, unfortunately. But we all stand together and we will share that burden. And Ireland is in the front row and we will share this burden as Europeans. And we will all see this coming and we all prepare. But at the end, one of the outcomes could be that we all work together in an even better way than we did in the past to share this, to share the impacts that are coming. And you mentioned the number, the numbers. 60% of German export go to the European Union. In the best of all times, it was 7% to the United Kingdom, but it has dramatically been reduced in the past 2.5 years. It's now less than 6%, heading towards 5%. And the EU27 is even more important than ever. And there is room for improvement. We can still do more business within the European Union in times where the world economy is slowing down. So we will probably work even closer together than we did in the past. And this is the positive message.
In the short term, though, what may happen within a couple of months comes at a bad time generally for the German economy. A sort of a perfect storm is building up in terms of the impact of Brexit, particularly on your exports, particularly your auto exports to the UK, but also the whole global trade tensions between the US and China that's impacting on your trade. How would you profile the German economy at the moment? You're teetering into technical recession, perhaps?
The direction is clear. The problem that we're facing is not the bilateral effect of the trade conflict between the United States and China. So German business in the United States or German business in China, there it's also affected. But the real effect is that world economy is slowing down. Mm. And the business model of Germany is export. So when we talk about the so-called German Mittelstand, family-owned businesses, they are perfect in selling their products all over the world. If we have a general slowdown of the world economy, they're all affected. So this impact is larger than the bilateral impacts. So this comes at a very inconvenient time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it always does.
It always does, but anyway, nobody wants the negative impacts of a Brexit. But it comes at that time. We had 10 years of fantastic growth rates, and we are still on a very, very high level. So yes, it's a reduction compared to the years before, but it's still on a very high level. We got used to that, especially politics got used to it, that there is a lot of money coming to be spent by the state, and we're just giving a small alarm that this is not going to continue. And then the question is how to react to this. Mm. This is the first recession that comes from Washington and London. We have had several recessions in the 70s. Sometimes it was about oil, then there was Kuwait, so it was security issues. And then we had a recession due to the new market. And then we had one that came from the banking sector. But this one is an announced recession, so you can prepare. And the question that arises in Germany is, when is the right moment to react to an upcoming recession? Some politicians say it's too early to interfere. Let the markets work, and we'll see. And if the situation worsens, then we will react. But it's like a ball falling down. You can stop it, and then you don't need that much energy at the beginning. But the later you interfere, the more power you will need to stop it. And this is the discussion that we have. We would like to see more public and private investments in Germany, and you can encourage that. There is a lot to do. If you, for example, go to Eastern Germany, you see that the infrastructure is very good there. It was newly built after reunification, but there are other regions in the country that also need an improvement of infrastructure. And then we talk about the totally different infrastructure, which is the digital infrastructure. Mm. If you've been to the Hanover Fair recently, it's not only about machines anymore that are being sold there. It's about machines with a data environment. And we talk about machines that are able to have machine-to-machine communication. And therefore, you need 5G. So we also talk about a 5G infrastructure, broadband in Germany. And there's room for more investments, and from the public sector, but also from the private sector. And therefore, we would, for example, need a reduction in taxes, because the average tax that is being paid by companies, if you add all the taxes combined, it's 32%, and that's quite a lot.
We all know the historic reasons, particularly since the costs of reunification, as to why German governments want to have balanced budget surpluses, if possible, and in fact, legislation has been enacted to limit the amount of deficit budget spending that can happen. If they don't loosen the fiscal strings, if your government doesn't do that, how deep do you think in the short term your economic troubles could become? Do you think the consumer will start getting worried by what they're seeing in manufacturing industry and stop spending and start saving more?
So far, this is not the case. Consumers are still strong. What we really recommend is to think about taxes. And there is a lot of money. The taxes that are being paid are the highest ever in the Federal Republic of Germany. So the state is rich. It's extremely rich. But the spending goes mostly to social welfare. And what we ask for is that some of the incredible amount of money that is being raised is being spent for the future of the country.
Do you think that's going to happen quickly enough under the current Angela Merkel coalition government?
There is still time. Then we have to look at the political situation in Germany at the moment. There's a grand coalition. One of the partners is rather weak at the moment. They're looking for a new leadership. There are 8 teams running for this leadership, and the decision will be made by a party congress in December. So until then, I don't see a solution of this. But what is upcoming is there's the 20th of September, where the Grand Coalition wants to publish a plan how to deal with climate issues in Germany. And connected with this, there could be a huge plan of investment. The technology is there. The companies are willing to do it. But 80% of the measures are not profitable. And we need to talk about how to reduce the cost of the transformation of the energy system And we as the BDI did a study that there will be huge investments needed to reach the 2050 targets.
So which are very ambitious, aren't they? Almost carbon neutral within 30 years.
Well, we said we are the largest industry in Europe. So for us, it's even more difficult to reach these targets. And we said 80%, minus 80% CO2 is possible from today's perspective. But we need a close cooperation between state and business to find the right ways to implement these technologies that are not yet profitable.
And what level, what scale of investment between public and private do you think Germany alone needs to achieve those very ambitious carbon emissions targets within 30 years? We keep saying 2050, but it's only 30 years away.
Yes, and we need to get going. That's the problem. We're talking a lot about different targets all over the time, but we need to start doing something. And this is what business people like. And they're willing to invest, but they also need intelligent investment conditions. So what we said is we need 1,500 billion until 2050 to get the job done. This is a large number if you look at it, but if you compare it to annual spending, it's something that is feasible. But the precondition is it must make sense for the companies. So what we did, we put all the measures in a line and started with those that are almost profitable, and the last ones are the most expensive ones. And we said, why don't we start with those that are almost profitable instead of focusing on things that are extremely expensive now, but where we can talk about reducing the costs within the next 5 to 10 years. For example, how do we produce steel CO2-free with hydrogen? This is an interesting question. It's possible, but it's not something that we are going to do tomorrow. But we need to start, and we need to talk about who is going to pay for what. And this is coming to a conclusion on the 20th of September, which will be an interesting day for maybe the start of something new in climate issues in Germany.
You represent, I think, about 100,000 businesses and 8 million employees. Huge power there. But a lot of people in this part of the world look to Germany as a model of economic efficiency, innovation, investment. But there are lots of structural problems and challenges within the German economy. Your roads network, your rail network leads a lot of investment. Your broadband perhaps is quite as bad as ours, which is a surprise to people. There's a catch-up to be done there, isn't there?
Yes, and there is a huge difference between what companies do and what the state does. We all see that there is an enormous development in speed. Our companies need to adjust to the speed that we see in Asia, for example, and they do this. Decision-making processes are being changed in companies. The structure of companies is being changed, but the state doesn't change the way it works.
So you're over-regulated, over-bureaucratic,
yes,
do you think?
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes, so the reaction that we see is that more and more companies try to do business without any contact to politics. But sometimes you need permissions. And the permitting process in Germany is just too long. And we've had a special legal situation after reunification. We reduced the number of regulations just for the investments in the infrastructure in Eastern Germany. But the mistake was after that, we came back to the normal regulation. We should have stayed with the regulation for Eastern Germany. And so one of our constant arguments is that our politicians have to deal with the issue of overregulation. It kills business.
Do you think the reputation of German business, of German industry, has suffered over recent years? The likes of the Dieselgate scandal in Volkswagen and other companies, how long it's taken to build Berlin Airport. Your banks are in a bad way. Your big banks are in a bad way. This all comes as a surprise to people on the outside who have always looked to Germany as a model of efficiency, of getting things done on time and properly.
Well, there are some issues that you mentioned, but it's not an overall issue. If you look at, you mentioned the number of companies that we represent, and We have the DAX companies, but we have like 95% of our members are the typical German Mittelstand, which is not an SME, but a family-owned business, maybe up to 10,000 people working there or even more. But they have a different focus. They have long-term views and they're very strategic they are very strong and fast and outbound. So I don't see any reason to worry. It's what I'm worrying about is really overregulation from a national perspective, but also from a European perspective. And we also have to keep in mind that the rest of the world usually doesn't act as complicated as we do. And this sometimes harms us. This is something that we really need to discuss and to get better.
On that point, Germany being the largest economy within the EU and certainly when the UK goes by far, the European Commission, there has been a lot of pushback from German and French companies. The proposed Alstom-Siemens merger, which was prevented by European competition authority competition regulations. Do you believe that the new commission needs to look again at its competition policies, that we do need to build up EU-European champions across borders to deal with what's happening in other competing economies like the United States, like China?
That's an absolutely fascinating question that we have discussed in our membership. The very large companies, of course, like the idea of a European champion, but 98% of our members don't, because they're small, they're fast, they're strong, and they say, we don't need European champions. We are champions, we are hidden champions, and we can make that. But on the other hand, we need to look at the reality maybe outside of Europe. If you want to get a contract in India or somewhere in Asia or in Africa, your competitors come from, for example, China. And if we take that railroad issue, CRRC is a monopolist.
This is the Chinese state.
That's the Chinese state-owned company. And it's a real strong competitor. Siemens alone is too small to compete with it. Alstom alone is too small. Even they together could be interesting. And the argument was in Brussels that they're not yet in Europe and it's far away. So maybe it's not a question of changing regulation in Brussels, but maybe having a different view in time. It's not just about the next 2 or 3 years. Maybe we should look at the longer distance. And also, it's not only about the European market. It's also, we should take into account that there is a world market. And what is the role of this world market? Because some of these monopolists, they start their business in Asia where they're at home. Then they go to another continent and at the end they come to Europe. What we've seen now is that CRRC is already in Austria and it's about to buy a railroad company in Germany. So they are now only a few months after that decision in Brussels, sooner than expected, they are in Europe. And maybe today that the decision would be different.
You mentioned earlier the relatively high corporation tax rate that affects your members, 32%.
It's corporation, it's corporate tax and a business tax that only exists in Germany. And added, it's 32%.
Do you look at the corporation tax regime here in Ireland, perhaps in the same way as our French friends do? And do you believe that our 12.5% rate, particularly for multinational investment into Ireland, and particularly in terms of digital, the taxation of large digital companies, that does need to change, that effectively the EU generally, individual countries like Germany, need to be able to reap the taxes from digital activity in your country and not have it all coming to a small country like Ireland?
We would be happy if we could reach the OECD or the Eurozone level, which is 25% in OECD countries and even less in the Eurozone countries. 12.5% sounds fantastic. The answer needs to be European. We need a European common tax base. And therefore,
and that is coming, isn't it?
It is coming, and we need it, because if we don't get it, we will see the reaction like the one in France. We did not support the French idea of a digital tax, but the answer cannot be so differing national tax schemes in the European Union. So if we really are one European Union, we need a common tax base. So any tax base will be lower than the German one. So at the end, we might be happier than today.
You wouldn't necessarily be supportive of the idea that small economies like ours, geographically away from the periphery of the European market, need that extra competitive edge, perhaps through their tax regimes.
There should not be a way to evade tax paying in other European countries. Otherwise, this will cause political problems, as we have seen it. In some countries, people get really angry when they have the feeling that large companies don't pay taxes in their country and find ways to evade that by paying less taxes in another European country. It's a political issue. It's not only about business. It's also about the feelings of people that it's not just. And therefore, I think we are on a good way to find a common tax base in the European Union.
We talked at the start of our conversation about perhaps we are all beginning to appreciate more the benefits of being members of the European Union and the single market. Are you concerned at all that the growing dissatisfaction by citizens of the former East Germany, many of whom are actually saying they don't necessarily fully support the democratic model that's in your country at the moment, that sort of dissatisfaction, for whatever reason it's there, could lead to the same sort of anti-EU sentiment that's built up in many of the industrial cities in the UK?
The sentiment is all over Europe. So it's a task of the next European Commission, but it's also the task of us in the companies. We all profit from that system to explain it again and again, how good this European system works for all of us, for the citizens, but also for businesses. And it's a stabilizing factor. And we should all be happy that we have developed it to such a strong region in the world. And there will be no issue that we can handle on a national basis in the future, even if people like to ignore that digitization is coming and that everything is going to accelerate the life that we are living. But we can handle it, but not on a national basis. We need European answers to international problems.
Finally, more and more Irish companies are targeting the German market mm-hmm. for export, also to actually base some of their activities there across a range of activities. What would your key piece of advice be to Irish companies who are looking, particularly if there is now a major public investment and private investment program in the German economy through decarbonisation or whatever else, what would your key piece of advice to Irish businesses be who are looking to Germany perhaps to grow and expand?
First, you are welcome in Germany. We would like to increase the amount of business that we have between our two countries. And I would not limit it to a certain sector. You have a lot of strength in Ireland and you can use them. And it's a big market all over there in Germany. And we already are in contact, but it can always be more. And there is a good way of logistics between our two countries, but it can be improved. We have a very fantastic interior harbor in Duisburg, for example, and I think that there are more ways to come to Germany than in the past by using a land bridge. But there's also a way to use a sea bridge and train and railway system.
And would it help to establish a base in Germany that you show your commitment to growing within the German economy by setting up an office there or setting up some sort of a physical location there?
Yes, absolutely. You will all need offices somewhere on the continent, and going to the largest industry there is never a mistake.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Fascinating conversation. Dr. Joachim Lang, Director General of the Federation of German Industries and member of the Presidential Board, thanks indeed for talking to us.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. You'll find us as a weekly podcast from Friday mornings on the new Go Loud app, available to download now in the App Store or on Spotify and the Apple Podcast Player. So just search for Taking Stock and you can find us there. So from Taking Stock with me, Vincent Wall, take it easy.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. AI is transforming business. Read our six AI priorities you can't afford to ignore at pwc.ie.